stand at issue? I'm going to convert the rest of you fuckers. Okay, let's welcome our wonderful guest. This is Emma Kennedy. Joe Caulfield. Sarah Pasco. And Roisin Conaty. Look at this. There's like this. There's five women on stage, and it's not Calendar Girls.
And you're not blonde, yeah. Mickey.
Yet.
Like, you're not blonde.
It's not Calendar Girls yet.
Yeah. Have you bought baked goods to put over our knockers?
I don't reveal the secrets.
So just a little bit about Standard Issue that you can see behind you. It's a magazine started by Sarah Millican, and it's to celebrate women and how ace women are. And that's what tonight is about as well, because it is very rare that you see five women on stage that aren't in Calendar Girls or doing the vagina monologue. So, I'm going to kick off with a question.
And we're not raising any money for breasts
or
any other bits.
You don't have to give us anything. Imagine that.
That's the only reason normally you work with other women, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
None of us are doing a marathon.
Yeah. When did you first realise that you were a feminist?
My mum, single parent, and so maybe after my dad left, she had bought lots of feminist literature, as in it was recommended to her or other women gave it to her, and she did not read it, but I did. So I'd read, like, The Woman's Room and Female Eunuch and Our Bodies, Ourselves. A lot to find out about sex, actually. But I was... I was about 11 or 12, and it was at 13, which is where I have the strongest memory, because I used to fight a lot at school. And at 13, I kind of announced to people that I was also fighting boys now, because I was a feminist. And sometimes those fights were because of things that had been said. Now, you're right about the 90s. I don't know if it was worse than any other generation, because I didn't grow up at any other time.
No.
It's really odd, you know. I've been reading lots about the memory and how you remember things really clearly sometimes from 15 years ago that you haven't thought about in a long time. And I remember how often, just like members of my family, like male uncles and stuff, if you walked past a fish shop, they'd go, "Close your legs."
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, that wasn't the 1800s, that was my adolescence. Anyway. So I identified as a feminist very early, and I tried to set up societies at school, and I had lots of kind of causes that I liked to get angry about, and so feminism was one of them.
Well, I'm lacking a light bulb moment, I'm afraid.
Get off the stage.
I know, but it's funny, I was talking about this with Emma, also Irish Catholic background. So lots of aunties in Northern Ireland who seemed to do whatever they wanted, and what they wanted to do was smoke. And they would smoke and play poker till 2 a.m. Mm. and seem to rule everything, you know. And I think my teenage was, there was Debbie Harry, there was Chrissie Hynde, there was Susie Sue. So I never really thought about feminism because there was lots of women who were just amazing and doing things. My very best friend Adam was gay. So he obviously had a slightly different attitude and encouraged me to be quite loud. And our main problem was we were the only new romantics in Oakham. That was our our main problem at the time, that people didn't accept us. So I think it was only... And then later I remember reading Virago Press became a thing, because I lived in a squat in London, and everyone was very, like, into causes, and I was into
save the whale
boys and getting drunk. And so I did read a lot then, and I remember being very annoyed by things, where any books where women didn't have any choices or weren't allowed to do things. And although I like Jane Austen now, when people are going, "Oh, read Jane Austen," I was going, but all they do is sit and wait, you know, and they go, "Oh, is that a man coming to the house? Oh, no, he didn't stop." And I remember sort of being very annoyed at that sort of thing. But then I joined a band, and I come from, my mum is very like, she would do everything for my dad, you know, but I don't think it was any at a point where I thought I can't do something because I'm a woman, but I was very aware that that there might be people who would say that. I've heard that that happens, was kind of in my head. Mm-hmm. But I thought, oh, I haven't come across it. And just always thought, well, I can do what I like. I remember having a row with my brother because he said, what a wanker, like, I was about 9, and I said I wanted to be a vet. And he said, and I remember it so clearly, he said, well, you won't be a vet because you're a girl. You'll be a nurse. Mm. And I asked a nun at Catholic school, I said, do I have to be a nurse? And she said, no, you be whatever you want. That's nuns even said to be whatever you want. Yeah.
And talking about your experiences as a woman, you realise it's exactly like what Sarah said when I started stand-up, just talking about your everyday experiences as a human woman. I've noticed this, it's a new thing they do that annoys me sometimes, when women talk about politics or anything that isn't maybe sort of emotional, they sort of say, oh, they're doing feminist stuff, and you go... They're doing political stuff and feminism. It's part of politics. It's a political thing. And it's, I think women only get called, it's just sort of going, we're doing feminist stuff. And like our stuff is, I think if you're on stage talking about your existence, I think stand-up's fundamentally quite a feminist act. You're saying my life and our stories are worth being told and heard. So if I'm talking about, you know, shitting in a bin, which I've never done, and I've got no routines on, genuinely, but that's,
I
you know,
did once. I had to.
Well, I should think so. I hope it wasn't that full.
I was having a new bathroom fitted. And I've got two stories related to big bathrooms being fitted and terrible things women have had to do. So my story about... Do you really want me to tell you that?
Yeah.
All right, okay. So... there was a Polish builder and he had removed the toilet... that wasn't because he was a Polish builder. It was just I had a Polish builder. And he'd removed the toilet, and I didn't realise he'd actually physically removed the toilet, and I really, really badly needed a poo. And so I went into my garden and took the bin with the bin from my office. And this is how you do
it. Why didn't you just shit in the garden?
Yeah.
No.
What's the bin ever done to you?
No, that's not right. And so
the bin looks like you're collecting shit.
No way. So I took my office bin and I got a bin bag. See, you're with me now. And I put the bin bag in the bin and then I did a poo into it. But I am overlooked by neighbours. So it was perilous. Every strain was perilous. I could have been discovered moment.
I thought you were going to take the bin daylight. Into the bathroom.
No.
That's what I mean.
I couldn't go in the bathroom because the builder was in the bathroom.
Okay.
So I had to go into my garden to do a poo in my bin.
You've not got any bins in the house. The bin is your choice.
The
bin is a thing you've added. You don't need to shit in the bin. You've got. If I was looking out the window and I saw you shit in the garden, I'd be like... Something's happened in a bathroom, I imagine. She's all right. She's okay. She hasn't had a breakdown.
Well, that's
someone's shitting in a bin and then bringing it back inside like that's for later.
I did. I had to carry my own poo. I had to carry my own poo through the house.
Then they're like, there she is collecting her shit again. She'll show it to you if you go round.
If I thought it through, I would have given it to my dog as payback. But my best poo story involving a bathroom... was a very famous EastEnders actress, I won't name her, who was having a new bathroom fitted, and she really needed a poo. And she went in, and all the builders were in there, and she said, okay, can everyone get out? And they all sort of... that none of them spoke any English, so she couldn't communicate properly with them. So she shoved them all out, and she said she did a poo the size of a child's forearm. And she flushed, and at that point realised that, you know that pipe that goes that way? It was pointing that way. And she watched as the poo flew out like a weasel, and it fell through a hole in the floorboards, where it then landed on the kitchen floor, where they were all having a cup of tea.
Oh, my God.
I'm really glad we got the feminist stuff out of the way first.
Can you imagine that? What would you do?
Kill myself. I would kill myself. That's it. Done.
What would you do? All she could hear was the screaming.
So Standard Tissue is our magazine.
Women poo. It's quite a feminist thing to talk about. No, you have to pretend you don't shit half the time. Anyway, that sort of thing, isn't it?
What was the question? Where were we up to?
Feminism.
Yeah, feminism.
Does it influence and inform your writing? You're pooing? Anything?
I primarily think of myself as I'm a writer, whereas you're all more like you're brilliant performers and stand-up. And something that I am always very conscious of is giving my female characters proper characters, because there's something that drives me round the fucking bend. It's lazy, lazy male writers, especially of sitcoms, that their female characters, they can't be funny. They just have to either be feed lines, or they're the girlfriend. Or
people who destroy the fun.
Yeah, they are people James. Who destroy yeah, the sensible. Fun.
I don't think this is a good idea, James.
Yeah.
Drives me round the bend.
Although as Joe in Man Down, that you're very different. You're not the fun destroyer at all.
No, I think, I think that's I think she's fucking loon. Like, so it's completely different. That's quite fun. And she's ditzy, but not in a sexual way, which is important. You know, I think it's kind of, I don't mind that she'll, she's a fool. And because you do with, you do feel that, especially if you're, a woman sort of talking about feminism or trying to, do what you believe is right. It's quite hard sometimes, the jobs you get offered and saying no to things and stuff like that. And with Jo in Man Down, I was a bit like, how silly is she going to, you don't want to be like, but I was like, oh, she's a div. But she's a mat, like it's not a sex, she's like a loon, and she creates chaos rather than she's a receiver of the chaos. It's quite a fun role to play, and I think Greg tries to, make her sort of a little bit different, So it's a nice character to play.
Yeah, she's not kooky. That's the one where if you are allowed to be funny, it has to be, like you say, in a kooky. Oh, she's fun, I'd marry her. You have no sort of power over the fun you're creating.
Exactly,
Whereas your person doesn't.
Yeah, and she's not marriage. Yeah. Not sort of like, but she's kind of. I think I'm writing a sitcom at the moment as well, and it is quite, you realise, even yourself, and I think if you're really honest, you know that you can't be what you can't see, and sometimes you write a thing and you think, no one talk, and you realise that, the sort of holding. I've never been in a sort of vibratory conversation. Like, I've never been like, girlfriend, you need to just get this up you. Fucking. Like, I've never experienced it. But everyone thinks that's what my life, they're like, you're single, you must be just fucking buying dicks everywhere, right? And, and you're like, no one talks like that. We talk quite seriously and quite honestly about things. And like, what do you do when your mum gets old? Things like that. They're conversations
that you. On the train home, I am going to tell you to get a vibrator up you.
Get yourself.
Missing from your friendships.
Yeah, and I just think seeing female friendships in there, because it's a thing, and I'm not going to go, the whole women funny, blah, 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 let's just do it very quick. But my point is, you have your biggest laughs with your same sex. It's a gross, generalisation, but I firmly believe that those laughs where you can't breathe are with your friends. There's not, as much as I like to think I've made sisters, people laugh, or your sister, where you go like, I'm going to piss myself, I'm going to... And sometimes I don't think they get that on screen, where girls are like, you being a dick with women being like... like my sister when she was 9 years old, and I think if you put this in a film, or a script, they'd be like, that couldn't happen. My sister jumped out of me behind the door when she was 9 years old in a Mac going like that. And it's hilarious. My mum, everyone knew it was hilarious. But I was like, but they'd give that to the guy. They'd give that to the boy. Yeah. They wouldn't give that to the 9-year-old girl who's not mentally disturbed. Do you know what I mean? They'd be like, okay, so she's the mental child. But no, she's quite funny at her age. She found the match. She knew what she had to do. Well, that's a prop that I'm getting, that's getting used.
There's a certain... I'm so happy to hear you say that about the vibrator conversation, because there's a certain type of what is supposedly women's humour... that I always think, God, there's something wrong with me, because like you, I've never had conversations with my girlfriends about that, and also that as an ageing lady, I don't sit around with looking at young men going, oh I shouldn't, should I? There's something so unpleasant about all that, and all that kind of 50 Shades of Grey, and all that, it's so very insulting to women as you get older that you should just be constantly lusting because you've lost all your sexual power, so you just sit around going rubbing yourself at young men. That's seen as like that's the only value you have, and you've lost your value. So I've never thought of that as being my only value. And also, I think it's very creepy if I'm around a 20-year-old boy and then I was to be rubby around him. I just think I'll hand myself in to the authorities, you know.
You just see it received to you.
Slightly now want to see a TV show in which you go and slightly try and rub yourself up against 20-year-old men. Have you read 50 Shades of Grey?
No, I read a tiny bit.
Any of you read it?
Genuinely, no.
Has anyone here read it? Okay, so I was on holiday in Italy, and I'd read all the books I'd brought with me, and when you go to some houses that you've rented for a holiday, and they'll have like a bookshelf with books on it, and it was there. And I thought, right, do you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to read this book. And if my job is being a writer, and the one thing you do not do is, number one, is begrudge anyone their success, because that just makes you wrong. And number two, you don't denigrate other writers, okay? E.L. James is the worst fucking writer in the universe. She's also now the most successful writer in the universe. If I got a piece of paper and did a diarrhea on it and got ants to run through it, that would be better written than 50 Shades of Grey. What I don't understand about 50 Shades of Grey is I completely understand that people wanted to read something that was vaguely erotic, but even the eroticism in it is shit, but it's so badly written. And the thing that I can't comprehend with that book is that this isn't a book that was published. This is a book that became the massive success through word of mouth. So that required people to stand in front of other people and go, oh, you must read this book.
Okay, so but the interesting thing is about people who've read and really enjoyed 50 Shades of Grey, because obviously, as we know, there was a huge amount of majority women who did, is that they didn't come to it because they had read lots and lots of books and this was the next book they were reading. For lots of them, it was the first book they'd read in a decade or since school. So actually, I think while lots of people go, oh, okay, she does repeat words occasionally and it's clumsy similes and things like that, but it was a book that was so easy to read and easy to get into. It got people actually reading again. You know, like in the way that people don't like The Da Vinci Code. That's another example of this phenomenon.
Great book. No.
Dan Brown is what he is, but he does write page turned.
But I think that's what 50 Shades of Grey was for some people. Mm. It was just something they were imagining in their heads.
I haven't read the book, so
my friend's got a theory about all of the bondage in S&M, and she says that actually, and it's a really interesting theory, that fantasy comes out of the opposite. So if you are a subdued woman, the idea of being subdued is not sexy. If you literally have a man who's in charge of your autonomy, your fertility, who tells you when you have to have a smear, then it's not going to be sexy.
Does he do that in the book?
Yeah. Fries are in a helicopter to have a smear.
Really? That's a joke, right?
No, it's not a joke.
I mean, I'm going to read the book, guys.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck. But good luck with the 150 pages that is just the legal contract.
Yeah, well, that's it. So it's basically a marriage contract from the olden days, in terms of that she can't say no to him and she has to sign away all of the
consent. Well, he pays for everything.
But my friend has this idea that actually people are so busy now. Like people, when they're not at work, they're studying, they're trying to best themselves, they're trying to have the best lives they can. The idea of someone, she said, the idea of someone tying you up and then cleaning up afterwards is actually pretty nice. Yes. Don't worry about it. And everything's white clean.
Yeah, you have to study why people like it. People like the book, and they feel is that you know, you want an app to exist sometimes. I wish I could just run on an app now. And if you've had this sexy guy who's rich, I mean, it's awful. It sounds awful, and that, you know, the ethos.
But it's made up. It's fiction.
Yeah.
It's like going, the guy's an octopus. He's got eight arms and does weird things.
The reason why it stands out, I think that's the reason why we're discussing it, is because there isn't loads of real, like, good sex books for women where you're like, fucking hell, that book really got me going. that book was a really... Do you read this? We have these sort of not really... We have this sort of... It's, you know, really shit books that are, like, jokey.
But there's a huge pornography industry which is catering in the majority. Mm. The consumers are men. Yeah. And actually, they're not. Lots of women do use the internet to look at porn. But until 50 Shades of Grey, it wasn't porn created by a woman that actually just did work for lots of men.
Yeah, interesting.
Although there's always Jilly Cooper.
Could put lesbians in her books now, isn't she?
Oh, yeah.
You finally exist.
When did you realise that you were funny, and how did it manifest itself? And from then, when did you think, I can make a career with this?
I've got a strange background, and don't be too like strange background. Read the book. I don't mean like, I just mean a bit of a weird childhood in some ways. And I think funny was very much a thing I learned when I was very young.
As a kind of currency.
Maybe, or maybe I'm from a very funny family. So my family are all like, my mum's got 12 sisters, and all of them they're very funny and they're very giddy. You know, they're very, very giddy people. They're not like sort of, you know, Irish Catholic, like, they're very like sort of. I was at a funeral with them, and my auntie Breeder is always obsessed that her car's going to be towed, even though she lives in the middle of the country. And the younger sisters, because there's 12, there's quite a generational gap. Breeder's like in her 60s. And the younger ones, what was really funny, they paid the guy £20 at a funeral to say the car's getting towed at the... And I was a bit like, okay, there, this is where it's from. So I sort of give myself credit. Like, it was probably, you know, when did I work out? And I go, these guys, look at them, you know, I'm watching this 60-year-old run out. And I think I sort of, my mum was very funny, and I think I probably use it maybe as a defence thing. I think we had a bit of a troubled childhood for a while. Like, my mum and dad got divorced, it was all a bit messy, and I think I used it to be quite like up, make my mum happy, and, you know, tits and teeth, like, oh, you know. I never thought I could do comedy. Like, I didn't think it was a job that was open to me. It felt like a little bit like saying, I'm going to be a rock star. You know, like saying that out loud. I was in a pizza restaurant in Crouch End. I was like 24, 23. And I was sort of like, fuck my life up. You know, as you do, early 20s, girls, it's all going to be fine. But I was like, it's all shit. I was working in, and then my friend Danielle said to me, you should do stand-up. And I just needed someone to, I'd never said it out loud. And I was like, thank God, now I can do it. You know, I just needed someone else to say it. And I literally walked across and put my name down for Downstairs at the King. I had no plan. And it was sort of first gig, you know, as everyone, you know, good. Second gig, terrible. So, yeah, I didn't really have a... There was no sort of like, oh, yeah, I should be doing this. This is my calling. It's been very much like that. And sometimes I think, like, I'm pretty funny. I should be on stage. And other times I'm like, kill me. Just kill me.
Emma?
I didn't realise I should be doing what I was doing until I was about 27. But sort of if I look back at myself, especially when I was in my late teens... I had a particularly sort of competitive correspondence with a girl in the year above me who was called Alison McCauley, who I suppose to all intents and purposes my best friend when I was sort of from 16 through till 18, and obviously I grew up in the era where we didn't have phones or email or anything like that, so we literally properly wrote to each other every single day. And it was just to make the other one laugh. And we did there must be 2 years at least of a correspondence.
Do you still have them?
I would absolutely love to see those letters. But at one point, simply for her amusement, I wrote the entire book of Paradise Lost, book one, but based at our school. So it's sort of, the clues were there that this is probably what I should be doing. But I became a lawyer. I don't even know how that happened, because I did an English degree. And somehow I ended up at law school after I'd done my English degree. And then actually became a lawyer. I had a secretary called Madge. and people would come in to see me with plastic bags full of documents, and they'd be furious. Because that's what you're dealing with when you're a lawyer. You're dealing with people who are generally very angry and want to sue people and want justice. And I think I got a sense that it wasn't for me when... You know, I would sit listening for an hour to these people who were very ranty and wanted me basically to almost kill someone. And I just look at them and just go, just let it go. I was just sitting on the tube one morning and I looked down the carriage and I thought, oh my God, everyone looks grey and ill. I can't do this for the next 40 years. And I walked up to my senior partner's office and I said, I've got terrible news, I'm leaving. And he said, well, where are you going? Who's headhunted you? I said, no, well, I'm going to write comedy. I'd never written a word in my life. And I said, I'm just going to write comedy now. And then I did.
What happened to Madge?
To Madge? Oh, she was... Do you know what? I loved Madge. But every single morning, she was the first person I'd have to deal with because she was always crying. So constantly crying. She'd come in... and I wouldn't understand what she was saying to me. I said, "What, Madge, what is it now, Madge?" And it was always something to do with a boyfriend. Or weirdly, something to do... with chemicals that cleaned carpet.
Sarah?
I didn't like comedy, thought it was very stupid. I wanted to be an actor since I was 12, and I didn't know how to do that, but I knew that that's what I wanted to do, to pretend to be other people. And then when I got a bit older, 18, 19, I decided I wanted to be a physical theatre performer in political pieces.
Very specific.
Yes, because I had this. I knew that acting was a very selfish job, and I thought it was. I could only do this very selfish job if I also then was changing the world. So it's like I'm changing the world, but everyone's watching me do it, like that. And then I tried to be an actor for a very long time, since I was 18, and I auditioned for drama school for years and years, and I did lots of. Sort of devised theatre in old people's homes and theatre and education and street theatre and lots of things like that. And then when I was 27, I was in like a little sketch review show in London where you get to kind of write sketches. And I've never ever been funny socially. Like I'm not.
That's not true.
I'm not like.
I wouldn't hang out with you. I can't do small talk.
But I'm not. We have very in depth conversations analysing people.
Yeah,
we
punctuated don't, like, with dick jokes.
Okay. I've got a bit better, but I was never like the class clown. Lots of comedians they always knew they were funny, and I was never. I've always been crying, and about how awful the world is. But then I found comedy, and for the beginning it was a hobby. So, and I'm still very much in a honeymoon period. It's amazing that it pays my rent because I'm so grateful for it, and that it made me. Well, it changed everything in my life in terms of the people that I met doing it, and the fact that it made me have to think so much about what I thought about the world in order to share that with other people. And there's something so stimulating about how everything that happens in your life then literally feeds directly into your work. Mm-hmm. So it all feels like this really brilliant process. And so for me, it's never been about gags. It's always been about myself.
Very honest. Is there anything that you wouldn't talk about for a gag? Is there anything that's personally off limits?
The problem I have with jokes about sexual assault, which is the big one, is that it's not that I don't think people can make really funny jokes, because they can. It's that physiologically there are certain trigger words, and actually they happen to all of us, depending on personal experience. For instance, if you have recently seen someone die of cancer, someone doing even a routine about it, you see that person again or you feel it. You can have physiological reactions. Certain jokes will upset all of us, but there's something about sexual assault which actually, if you're trapped in a room and everyone's laughing all at once, it can actually be really traumatic. Mm-hmm. And so that's, for me, why I have this one area where I think you can talk around things without using trigger words, is what I think. But that also doesn't mean that I would judge another comic for their decision on that.
What about you, Joe? Because you handle some fairly weighty political topics, but you do it in a very easygoing manner. Is there anything that you wouldn't consider
I'm thrilled if you think I handle weighty political topics.
You just rub against it like a 20-year-old man.
Well, we're back to the rubbing up against now again.
Like I say, I think... there's nothing worse than a bad joke about an upsetting subject. And there's a lot of jokes, comics will do jokes, and I do judge them on it, because I think you're not good enough to do that subject. So I object to that, and I think if you are going to do subjects that are upsetting to people, it's got to be a really good joke. And also, it's where it comes from as well. You can tell, what someone's got in their eye, if it comes from a good place, Or if it's just a cheap joke because they're doing it for a laugh, I go, that's not enough, you know. But also, you can upset people without knowing it. And that's, you know, no comics goes out to upset people. I do think some do, actually. Having said that, some do because they think, oh, it's really, you know, I'm dangerous. And they're not remotely, and they're usually badly dressed. I'd say anyone who says they're dangerous, look at what they're wearing. Oh. Sometimes it's something, it's also audiences can take you wrong. Like the other night, there was an American couple in, and I said to them, oh, if you can, just do me a favor, when you go back to America, can you just tell the police to stop killing black people? Because if they think we don't know, we do. We're hearing all about it. And I did it in a kind of gossipy way, but I meant it, and the audience were uncomfortable. The Americans were laughing. The audience was slightly uncomfortable, so then I had to say, oh, apparently it's just me. Everybody else is fine with it. No. But it was just that people went, oh, why is she mentioning killing black people? You know, it's just people don't really listen to what you've said. They just go, oh, I'm uncomfortable. We've gone into a weird area. And then I also had, this was so, I've never been actually so upset with myself. But again, I didn't know. There was a lady with her two teenage children, and I said to the lady something about, where's dad? The lady said, he's not here. And I went, oh, where is he? Said something a bit flippant. And she went, no, he's not here. And so I went, right, she doesn't want me to talk to her. Fine. So you normally get a thing, but I didn't think. Most awful thing, but she was so lovely about it. And this is what happens in life. She came up to me afterwards, well, after her daughter came up to me and said, I hope you're happy. You really upset my sister. My dad's dead. And her younger sister was crying. So I feel fucking awful, obviously. The mum said to me, really don't worry about it. How are you to know? They're going to have to live their whole life. People don't know their dad's dead till they tell them. You know. And I thought she was so lovely because she's going, oh, this is one of the hurdles they're going to have, is that people are not going to know their dad's dead. I mean, I've never felt so awful. I was so upset. But the mum was so wonderful because she completely absolved me of it. But you never know. And, of course, you don't mean to upset people.
No. You know. You don't know who's in your audience.
No, you don't. I mean, sometimes you can learn to tell, all right. But it's also one of the worst things where people go, oh, would you do joke about anything? And you go, sort of, if it's the right joke, sort of, you can. But also, it's like, I think also I would try to be on the side of the underdog. So I don't see why you're making a joke about the attacker. You know, why, you know, it's always like we should be defending the underdog and attacking those in power. That's what comedy should be. That's sort of the way it's set up. Unless you're letting the audience know, oh, I'm messing with this completely, and then they're laughing because they know you're messing with it.
No. Well, a little bit like Sarah was saying about wanting to change the world through your acting. But comedy does have that currency and the ability to make people think as laugh.
I think that's a very misleading thing.
Oh, okay.
I think comedy is really cathartic, and I think that it can be really, really fun. It doesn't agitate, to use, you know, like the kind of where, you know, when there was all of that kind of Brechtian style of theatre, that actually if you enjoy things too much, you're not going to get up and do anything.
Right, okay.
I think we should be really careful that watching a political comic tell you why that there's these systems in the world that are incredibly unfair, you can laugh and you go home and you feel kind of euphoric and you pat yourself on the back like, I agree with him, I'm one of the good guys. You don't realise you have done nothing. And so actually you should always, I'm always very wary of comics going, but actually we do good. It's like, no, we don't. We get paid a lot to have a child's job.
I think if I really cared, I would stop this and train to be a nurse.
If I really wanted
to do good.
It's very dangerous to say, like, oh, I say these kind of things, so I'm doing
something.
But if
it also takes, because, you know, you can do good, and I use the word, but talk about a thing on stage, and someone hears about a thing, and they find a thing, and, you know, kind of, so, but I think to take credit for a thing that you go, that's just a byproduct of me getting my laughs, and doing my job, and sort of doing it, you know,
And nothing ever goes in unless the punchline is good, and usually by the time there's a punchline, everyone's forgotten what you've said anyway, really.
I think the only thing where I do slightly feel, maybe I'm wrong, maybe you feel this, I do think, as a female comic, I do think if I do a good job, I think I've made the women feel better.
Yeah.
And feel better about themselves.
Yeah.
And go, well, she was good, rather than, well, she was a bit embarrassing.
But that's a lot of pressure
on you.
And
now I'm going to feel shit when I go to work, because it is embarrassing being female. It just is embarrassing.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of pressure on you, because the reason I find sometimes why I don't want to represent my gender is because I want to be able to be shit sometimes and not to have let the town. Like, I am bad at my job sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't want that to reflect on other women.
It's exactly what Jo says. You do feel, I don't want to feel like I ever hinder or I confirm a thing. And that's, it's getting less because there's so many more women to be seen. So you're just someone, you know, rather than... this person is shit, therefore, look what happened with her. We tried her, therefore, no more women. Yeah. Look what she did. You know.
But I think any woman in sort of a public sphere and in the public eye ends up representing all women. It's not just in comedy, it's on the
I think that's the thing. There's still, the world is run by white men, so there's always, you know, just one woman on something. And also, you get asked such a fucking annoying questions a lot of the time that you're angry. So you just come across and they go, oh, aren't women angry? They're not funny. Like you're saying, you're just like, oh, because you've asked me that really annoying, stupid question yet again. You know, that was very good. Was it you? I think it was you, Sarah, because I got very fed up with people. When I was on tour, people afterwards having a chat with me and asking me what my husband did. So I said on Facebook, oh, how many male comics get asked what their husband, what their wife does? Turns out, all of them. It wasn't a male-female thing. It was loads of comics going, yeah, they can't believe that you can make a living. So it was Bennett said, his wife's got a good job. So then they go, and you've got kids. What does your wife do? Oh, they're going, oh, that's how you pay the mortgage. It's just that people think it's a stupid job. Yeah. It wasn't actually a male-female thing at all.
No. As you all work in comedy, what never fails to make you piss yourself laughing? Let's start with Emma.
Oh, gosh.
Apart from shitting in a bucket in your back garden.
Well, other performers.
Anything.
Currently, the two people I'm obsessed with are Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. I think Tina Fey is one of the greatest comic writers. It doesn't matter that she's a woman. She's just absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. So I tend to admire people who are just really good at technically at what they do. Like one of my favourite stand-ups is Stuart Lee, simply because I like what he does. I like how he subverts it, and I like the stories that he tells. But weirdly, not weirdly at all. Well, the best stand-up gig I've ever been to was the Standard Issue one.
Yes.
That you organised, and the lineup was all women. And that was genuinely the best stand-up gig I've ever been to, ever. And I think, if most blokes, if you said, oh, do you want to come to a comedy night, it's all women on the bill, they'd all go, oh, no, I'm not going to that. But it's crackers, because it genuinely was the funniest comedy gig I've ever...
I like the fact that it's exciting now for women in comedy clubs. So for a while, and I think Joe will agree, and Sarah, there's a lot, and now there's a bit like, ooh, you know, there's that. They're like, oh, hello.
I love it. The Comedy Store at the moment are getting people tweeting them going, I've come three times and said I haven't seen a woman.
Yeah.
And then actually, before Christmas, and then they said, in the next 3 months, and then they said they had two women in 3 months.
Wow.
Like, don't worry, we're not bad. But I liked it that women as consumers as well, because that
want
is
to
part
see.
Of it.
They're like, where am I?
That's what changed in comedy clubs.
I really noticed now when panel shows, like they just have one woman or they have no women. Like I did a mildly angry tweet last week about the fact that the trailer for The Last Leg, it was like women don't exist. There wasn't one single woman in
but
that
it's
trailer.
Throughout the arts, and I think that's the thing, all of whatever field you're working in, you become aware of it, and then you look outside of your bubble, because I'm like, comedy's fucked. And then everyone goes, have you been in a boardroom, mate? And you're like, boardrooms and comedy, then fine. Everyone's like, have you been? You're like, okay, banks as well, whatever. Like, there's three things, and you look around and you realise, oh, like you say, right, you know, sitcoms, and you go, how many of them are leads, and how many of them are, you know, the owner of their own story, because women, so many sitcoms are the desired one or the discussed one, you know. And
Joe and Emma are going to stick around for a Q&A, but in the meantime, can we have a massive round of applause for Roisin Conaty and Sarah Pascoe, please?
We're going to get a drink. Thanks so much for coming out.
And then there were three. This is where the serious questions come in. Emma went.
You did your serious face.
I did my serious face, that's it. I don't have much serious questions. Then do you sit down and write and plan stuff, or could you do a lot of chatting with the audience when you do your gigs?
I do. I do sit down and write, but it doesn't often happen like that. But I think the very process of sitting down and writing helps my brain start working. I'm a great believer in the subconscious working things out for you. Mm-hmm. And I might say something on stage and then I go, oh, I could see people's ears prick up. There's something in that subject. And then I might write down what I said and think about it. But I'll often say things on stage because your brain is much better then, because the adrenaline, the fear of you staring at me is making my brain go, think of something to say. So if I've got an idea, I know it'll come out fully formed on stage much better than if I sit. Then I will often record it and then I write it down because I'll forget. So then I write down what I said and go, God, your grammar's terrible. But that is the other thing. If I write down, I don't write the way I speak, I'll go, well, I was walking along and I get very Jane Austen-y.
You totally do that.
Yeah.
Emma, do you have a fear that drives you and that makes you write? Because obviously your writing process is a little bit different.
No, actually. I think fear is the exact opposite of what I feel. I think fear is something that is that stifles you if you're creative, and you shouldn't be afraid of making mistakes. I think that's an absolute essential if you're creative, is that if you should feel that you have the space to get it wrong, because nobody, not even the greatest writers or performers, will get it right first time. And that's you know, by the time you present something to the public, you will have worked on that for possible months and maybe even years. So you have that time in order to get it right, but that's part of the process. But I write very, very quickly. A first draft of something, I just handed in an hour-long drama, and I wrote it in 2.5 days. And that's quite quick, but that's because I find writing dialogue very fast. But my initial process is just get it down, get it done, and then the work starts. So that I'm ready for notes. I'm ready to be told that this is wrong and that's not right, because that's part of the process. And I think also when you're a writer and you're writing specifically for actors, you also have to take on board the fact that although it's your idea and you started off and it feels like it's yours, it's not yours the minute you hand it in. From that point onwards, it's everybody's. It's the cast's, it's the director's, it's the producer's, it's everyone's show, it's not your show. So I always think that.
Hmm. And what advice would you give to someone who wanted to get into do comedy and to do what you do?
The only thing is to do it.
Just do it.
There's the only thing. Do it. Tape yourself so you know what you do if you do something good. I would say also listen to, which may be not the way some people would think, but I would say also listen to the audience, because an audience tells you who you are on stage. Like things you might think, oh, I'm this sort of person. And you go, oh, it doesn't work when I do that kind of stuff. They don't think of me like that. And then you know, like I notice, oh, people like it if I'm mean. And I'm a lovely person. But then you go, oh, that seems to work for me. And it's just by listening to what works with the audience that then you kind of go, oh, this, and you move to where you should be on stage.
Mm-hmm. And I think if you want to be a writer, it's the sort of the same thing. You just have to start writing. But it's the same as if you wanted to be a concert pianist. If you start on day one, you're not going to play Rachmaninoff's Fifth. You're going to start with Chopsticks. And you will get steadily better. And it took me about 10 years to work out what I was good at writing. And I think that's about right, actually.
Yeah.
It's that 10,000 hour thing that, you know, you will learn as you go along. And you have to have a skin as thick as a rhinoceros. And you have to leave your ego at the door. You can't have an ego when you're in a creative industry. I know that seems weird. Especially, that might be slightly different for a performer, but I think you just have to forget about yourself.
So if you are starting to do it, don't be put off by terrible gigs, because you will have terrible gigs, because you have to learn in front of people. It's the only way to do it. You can't, like, it's not like learning guitar. You can't practice at home and then go, oh, now I'll do a gig because I've learned some songs. You have to go out in front of people and ruin their evening. Do you know what I mean? I'm always amazed now I look back that people don't heckle more and aren't worse. You know, first they only let you on stage for 5 or 10 minutes because they know that you're ruining their evening. You know, but people are paid, yeah, and then they've got to listen to you for 5, 10 minutes, not know what you're doing.
I remember doing an Edinburgh show once, and it was so bad. And the director had this cunning wheeze. At the end of the show, we had to go off and come back on with painting frames around us, like, you know, like the ending of 70s sitcoms. And there was this one show where we went off, and by the time we had come back on with the frames, the audience were already trying to leave. And we just heard this one voice going, oh, fuck, they're back.
We got a couple of questions through for you on Twitter. Someone wanted to know what was the worst heckle you've received and how did you deal with it?
Heckling is a little bit of a myth. Like, there's nothing sticks out in my head because, weirdly, people are more polite than you think. So when you're very new, often you don't get heckles. People are like, oh, this person is so awful, they may kill themselves if we shout at them. And I notice when you start to get a bit better, then people heckle. But they're heckling in, and most heckling is joining in. It's that they're overexcited, uh-huh, and they're, or they're talking about what you're talking about, or they're like, she does that, and they can't contain their excitement. You know, so it's not actually bad. I've overheard, but I didn't take it badly. I foolishly, because I wanted to go to the Caribbean, so I did this cruise ship, me and this other comic, but it was what is called a formal cruise, which means that it's older people, but also they're all in dicky bows and everything. And what they like to do is go on cruises and complain about the cruise. They do, honestly, the entertainment said, oh, somebody complained about the weight of the cutlery. It's very heavy cutlery. Royal Caribbean's much lighter cutlery, right? And so we did the shows, and it was really weird because they didn't sort of understand comedy where I'm very conversational. They'd obviously only heard joke, you know, my wife jokes kind of thing. These things didn't happen sort of jokes. And so I did my thing, and I could tell they were just looking at me like, when is she going to sing? Like, like I wasn't doing anything. I was just talking. It was like, or magic. Maybe she'll do magic, but she's not done anything. And then me and this comic were sunbathing, and we heard this couple, and they went, oh, did you go and see the comedy? And we went, what? And this bloke went, yes. The girl was dreadful, dreadful. So the whole rest of the time, this other comic kept going, did you see the girl? Dreadful, dreadful.
Best heckle I ever heard was during an RSC production of Titus Andronicus. And if you don't know that play, there is a character called Lavinia who has her hands cut off. The actress playing her had her hands cut off, and there was a scene where she was dragging herself across the stage using a staff, sort of like that. Just, she was about halfway across the stage and she accidentally dropped the staff. And someone at the front, I mean, you could hear a pin drop, and someone at the front just went, butter stumps. I mean, how do you come back from that? You can't.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing, the actors, they're not allowed to answer back. They've got to pretend they're still in the Shakespeare play.
It was fun when I asked for questions on Twitter. They wanted to know about Joe's heckle, and they were like, what does Emma do on her holidays?
What do I do on my holidays? What do I do? Well, I mean, obviously, I have written a book about my holidays. I'm not that good at going on holiday. I tend to sort of get myself into all manner of scrapes.
I've made
a career out of disastrous holidays.
When I was 16, I went interrailing with my big sister. So she was 20. So I've just presumed, oh, she knows how everything works, not realising she doesn't know anything. And we went interrailing, but we only had I can't remember where we got to, but it wasn't very far as far as we wanted to go. So we hitchhiked, which now you go, why? You can't go, two women can't go hitchhiking. And we would just get lifts to the most terrible, well, not beautiful places, but we didn't have money. So I remember the weather changed, and then we were in the Alps, and we were absolutely freezing and really hungry. And then this man took us into the woods. Now me, I'm going, I'm 16, but I think sister, she knows. No, she hadn't a bloody clue. And I said, I don't think we should be staying in the car. He's going to the woods. And then he took us to the woods, said, you can camp here. We got camping. I'm looking around. Of course, 10 minutes later, he comes back in the car and he's waving money. And my sister's like, oh, it's okay, I'll speak French, I'll deal with it. And so he was offering us money for sex. Mm. And he said he'd put money on the window in the windscreen wiper and that we would have known that, right? So I got the saucepan
and I chased him
with the saucepan. And it was constantly getting lifts and then my sister going, right, next turning, jump out. It was constantly just being attacked by men.
Yeah.
Or, you know, lorries, you know. And, of course, they think that's why you're going to get in the lorry, you know. And I can't believe that she never thought any of this through. She was also, oh, well, he seems nice, this one. Then she was like, hand between my legs, next turning, jump out. It was just constant. And then one night somebody else would have to jump out of their car. And so we'd just camped here and we didn't know where we were. And then we woke up and we could hear this noise and we opened the tent and we were in a quarry surrounded by diggers and that. And it was just like, it was so miserable. But I completely put my trust in her that she would know. And then there was some sort of strike and we couldn't get back on the ferry. Mm. But we were taken in by this woman in Paris and nothing funny happened. She just heard our story and went, oh, you can stay with us till you can get... We had to get the bus to get the ferry, and she put us up for the night.
Oh,
and her husband was there, and no funny business at all. Gave us sandwiches to take with us.
Sandwiches as well?
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, that seems like the perfect, lovely story to end this evening. I'm just going to do a little plug. It's been behind us the whole time, guys. www.standardissuemagazine.com. It's feminist in attitude, and there is nothing on there that will make you feel shit about yourself. So please do check us out. Can I have a massive round of applause, please, for Emma Kennedy.
Thank you.
And Joe Caulfield.
And Nikki Noonan.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.